time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. Today we're going to be talking about neurofeedback, but first I want to remind you I have a new book out, Why Can't I Sleep Well? The book is available. You can easily find it at sleepsciencetoday.com. But today we're going to be talking about a new issue that we haven't covered yet. We've got Dr. Francesco Amico. And he is a behavioral neuroscientist, and he specializes in remote neurofeedback. He's got a presentation for us, and we're going to get into how neurofeedback may impact and affect sleep. So welcome, Dr. Amico.
Oh, thank you, Andrew, and welcome, everyone. It's a great opportunity for me to talk about neurofeedback and the neuroscience behind it. And over the last few years, I've had the opportunity and great pleasure to cater to several patients, tens of patients, and working multiple clinical populations, and of course, with patients with sleep problems. So I prepared a short presentation about what neurofeedback is, how it was discovered, and how it, in general, it helps, or may help people from different clinical populations, and of course, with sleep problems. And I'll briefly also introduce what I do and how I can serve patients remotely, no matter where they are in the globe.
Fantastic, fantastic. Thank you. So I know those of you listening on radio hear about us talking about a presentation. You can always see these shows and actually see the speakers and presentations. The show goes up on YouTube a week after airing live, but we're going to do our best to describe things in a way that you're not missing out on anything. So if you do want to see the slides, you can always join us on the YouTube channel at Sleep Science Today. But we're gonna cover everything here today. So let me pull up the presentation and we can get ourselves started with that. So, okay, so for those of you listening on the radio, I've got a basic presentation here. We're going to be talking about neurofeedback training, a lot of the background and evidence. So Dr. Amico, why don't you go ahead and take it away?
Yeah, sure. You can go directly to slide number two. I briefly introduce where neurofeedback comes from and how it was discovered. It was discovered by actually two people, neuroscientists, Barry Sterman and Dr. Wirwicke, a biologist, who were hired by NASA back in the late 60s to study behavior, attention. And they specialized in EEG, and they were interested in what happens in the brain when we start focusing. And they used different animal models, and in particular cats, to show that a cat before praying, when the cat is praying, is about to catch a mouse. Something really interesting happens in the brain in the EEG, and in particular to a specific frequency, which is called, which at that time was called a sensory motor rhythm. Today we call it low beta. And the cat increased systematically this particular frequency, and later, you can move to the next slide. In later experiments, they also studied, were hired to study the effects of a chemical contained in rocket fuel, because astronauts started to feel, to display seizures from exposure to it. And they realized that the specific changes in the EEG occurred when animals exposed to, again, cats exposed to this particular chemical. And they also later understood that it could manipulate the EEG to reduce the threshold for these seizures to occur. From those experiments, those experiments were absolutely seminal, absolutely key to nurture further research in the same field. And now, for about 50 years, research has been developing and looking for applications in multiple clinical populations. And today, we can move to the next slide, please. Today we have a multitude of studies showing that neurofeedback can be applied to nurture, facilitate self-regulation in the brain. And next slide, please. So what we see actually in clinical research is that neurofeedback can be used as a standalone, but also in a complementary intervention to improve the symptoms in persons with psychiatric disorders. And populations have included anxiety, depression, ADHD, persons in the ASD, with ASD, which is autistic spectrum disorder, and many other conditions and disorders. The main approach has been to break down, affect brain's activity, affecting or influencing different frequencies. So, generally speaking, we can break down in the EEG in five main frequency ranges. And selectively modulating or facilitating the change in these frequencies, it's been shown by research the brain starts functioning, naturally without any stimulation, simply by learning, and stuff starts functioning in a more balanced way. And very often this has been linked to an alleviation of symptoms and complaints from patients. For example, persons with attention problems have an increase in low frequencies, which are typically expressed during drowsiness. Persons who with attention problems, they feel drowsy and it can't really engage in a stimulus. They can't really attend a stimulus simply because they're some frequencies are out of balance. Now, how do we know? You can move to the next slide, please. How do we know that the brain is out of balance? This is done using an approach that is called a quantitative EEG. Basically, EEG is transformed, the EEG signal is transformed and turned into subfrequencies that can be mapped against a normative template. Basically, a template, a database, including data from persons never diagnosed with a psychiatric condition. So the system, there's software that allows us to compare automatically the data from the patient against this normative template and immediately, even at a glance, see where these imbalances are. And as I was saying, people with attention problems, like persons with attention deficit disorder, display an increase in low frequencies, especially in the frontal area. Persons with anxiety or depressive disorders often display, again, an increase in slow frequencies, but also imbalances between the left and the right frontal lobes. And many other, there's a vast amount of literature telling us where to look when we have a patient with certain symptoms. So we won't always want to relate the symptoms to AG imbalances that we see after running this running QEG, quantitative EEG, as I was saying. From research, we know that neurofeedback, and since it's completely, it's non-invasive, it has no side effects. In 60 years, it hasn't shown any side effect other than, you know, fatigue. We know that it can be used as a standalone or also complementary treatment or interventions in anyone who displays some neurobehavioral distress or changes. Simply because it is based on learning. So the neurofeedback specialist creates certain programs that tell the brain, okay, you start functioning, you're going to get a reward, which is typically, you know, administered through a video game or a video. Whenever you're going to be functioning according to this very program that I just created for you in this very region. So the brain, it typically learns quite quickly. And the more it does, the first time it happens only, you know, by chance, and then it happens again, and then it happens again. And then since we are completely wired to work according to salient what is important to us, things that are important to us in the environment. So the brain starts accumulating data and starts functioning according to that program. And then on a regular basis, the clinician looks at runs QEG, looks at, you know, what, for example, over a period of 4 weeks, what has been happening and if those imbalances are cleared. Now we have, you can move on into the next slide, please. We have, do you have, brilliant. There is, for example, I mentioned a number of, I gave a number of examples on clinical populations where neurofeedback has been shown to exert effects and to alleviate symptoms. And in particular, in sleep research shows that persons with insomnia may display several imbalances, especially in low frequencies, which are the frequencies that are expressed while a person is asleep. But also, and I see this over and over in my patients, persons with sleep problems, or in particular insomnia, have a hard time to relax in those moments that right before sleep, because before falling completely asleep, we go through a period where brain activity starts slowing down, and we go through a phase that's called the alpha phase. And if we can't put ourselves, we can't transition from, you know, being cognitively active to this alpha phase, we will never be able to fall asleep, to properly fall asleep, or we'll tend to wake up and all the time. So what I see is that in persons who are very, very active cognitively or tend to be, to think all the time, so to speak, sleep is a problem. But then we can go down, we can go actually deeper and see where, running a QEG, where the problems are during sleep. We can complement, so to speak, the information provided for example by standard EEG analysis and investigations in general, looking at, breaking down frequencies, slow frequencies in delta and theta. Now, I don't have the time to go through the role, you know, how these change during sleep, but mainly, you know, theta is is key during REM sleep and delta during non-REM sleep. So when we run a QEG and we look at all these maps per frequency, so we know where to go. We're not blindfolded. We're not just saying, you know, asking you, oh, are you sleeping well? And you're going to say more or less, yes, I'm sleeping well. No, we're going really deep. And so when it comes to creating a neurofeedback program, we know where to put our hands, where to put the electrode. And until we see that particular imbalances that we suspect is related to that that problem is cleared. So of course we want to know. I've published a paper on this. We never want to work on out of the box protocols. We always want to look at the data from the patient and start working with those imbalances that we, based on our interpretation of the literature, are likely to be related to a symptom. And if you know, that works, if the hypothesis for that particular imbalance is confirmed, great. If it is not, and we look at how the maps and how, you know, all those measures that we acquire during a QEG session are, you know, to display any change. And then we'll keep tweaking our approach until the patient starts seeing a change. This is achieved running what we call multimodal assessments. As I was saying, it's pointless. As a neuroscientist, I always say to my collaborators, to the clinicians I talk to, it's pointless in mental health, especially particularly. It's pointless to ask a person, how are you? Or how have you been sleeping well? Because the person is not going to remember it, and it's going to give us a very, very partial interpretation of how they're sleeping. We don't know, and very often patients don't even know they have a sleep problem. So until you run a QEG, and then you realize that their fatigue during the day comes from a sleep problem, it's not sleeping well. So the questionnaires or the unstructured interviews are very important, but also we need to run QEG or an EEG-based assessments. What I do also do is I run a major psychometric activity in patients. Basically, I get them to play with the cognitive task. And I see if their reaction times, if their sustained attention and level of passivity have changed. In persons with a sleep problem, even though they're not complaining about it, when reaction times are slow and when slow frequencies are underexpressed, especially during an eyes closed condition, then I start suspecting it's a sleep problem. Especially if there's some fatigue, you have to join the dots in a way. You have to, propose a hypothesis that among all the other symptoms, sleep is part of the equation. Can we go to the next slide?
Yeah, actually, so I'm going to take a real quick commercial break here before we go to the next slide. So we will be right back with Dr. Francesco Amico.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Good. Okay, welcome back to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're talking with Dr. Francesco Amico. We're talking about neurofeedback and sleep. So we were just about to move to our next section here. So give me one second here, and please continue, Dr. Amico.
Thank you. So typically, for many years, neurofeedback has been what patients were able to undergo neurofeedback treatments, going to a clinic, driving to a clinic, and sitting down and going through a minimal setup that takes about like 10 minutes, and then, you know, take their sessions. Now, over the years, advances in what we call translational medicine in this particular field have led to the development of many types of equipments, including equipment that very easily allows the average person to take neurofeedback sessions remotely, without the help, without a cap, like a standard cap, and using simply a tablet or a phone, using an app. So, and this all happens under the supervision of an expert or somebody who is trained in this field. And this is pretty much what I do. With my, I particularly use a system called MindLift. You can move to the next slide, please. That allows me to deliver my programs. Yeah, that's my programs using a very, very lightweight and simplified version of an EEG cap, which is a headset, and through an app that can be downloaded online. So my clients can then train automatically on those programs using video games that are created by are available in the MindLift app. It's not just any video game, or simply streaming from YouTube, Spotify, all these content networks. So they can. It's important, of course, that the person is really motivated to engage in a task. This is absolutely key. Again, our attention is part in the attention equation. Motivation is absolutely key. So it's the ability to stream from YouTube and to pick a video that interests us is absolutely absolutely important to achieve better results. You can move on to the next slide, please. There you go. I collaborate with, if you're based in the US, I collaborate with a clinic based in Florida, in Weston. It's called Neurotherapy. And we have patients from, different, with presenting different types of symptoms from different clinical populations, and including sleep, including chronic stress, or simply people who want to optimize their brain activity. People with CEOs working under stress, and of course who starts to explain very often sleep problems. If you're interested in doing neurofeedback under my supervision, you can contact Neurotherapy you can call them or simply go to the www.helloneurotherapy.com, neurotherapy.com, have a free call, a free meeting, and discuss your current situation, and then we'll understand or establish whether neurofeedback is the right intervention for you. Again, it's you don't have to do neurofeedback on its own. If you're already on medication or you're seeing a therapist, neurofeedback is actually a great way to provide, to develop or nurture those neural resources that it will allow the altogether, all the treatments to exert, hopefully, a positive outcome. Andrew, do you have any questions?
So, yeah, I mean, first off, thank you for such a comprehensive explanation there.
Thank you.
There's a lot in there, and so I do have a lot of questions that I'd like to ask to kind of flush it out a little bit more for a greater understanding from my side. So, first off, let's go back to just the concept of neurofeedback itself. So are we saying that maybe, for example, a patient might be working with a therapist on issues such as anxiety or sleep disorders or ADHD or whatever it may be, and there's a lot of traditional therapies out there that they work with, and you're saying neurofeedback would be a supplement to that or a replacement for traditional therapies?
I would say that it's a supplement. It's a complementary intervention that I would recommend. Especially, actually, all the reports that I create, whenever there's another therapist that is working with the patients, I like to work with the patient. I like to send them to the therapist. And for example, you know, if there is a questionnaire on anxiety, over time we'll see how, in a specific department, how, you know, those changes. And so there will be it's extra information, first of all, that the therapist can use to dig deeper. For example, if it is about sleep, you know, since sleep is also related, may be related to depression or anxiety. If there is anything that suggests that, so the therapist can go and explore other possible routes of sleep, of a sleep disorder. So it's a way to provide the biology behind the therapy, to help the therapist to give those cues that can maybe help and improve the clinical outcome.
Great, great. Okay. So you know, I guess the next thing I wanted to clarify is oftentimes, and maybe people who have no experience or knowledge of neurofeedback have probably never seen an EEG cap or anything. And we were you were explaining that before. And sometimes you can go into a clinic where they will attach all these different leads around your head.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, if you go in for a sleep study for polysomnography, they'll attach all these wires and things to your head. And sometimes they make that with a cap, almost like a bathing cap you would put on. It holds the leads. Mm-hmm. But what I'm going to ask in a minute, we're going to take another quick commercial break.
Sure.
But when we come back, what I'd like to talk about is more specifically what your technology that you use looks like. So mm-hmm. Let me take a quick break. We'll come right back in just a minute.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, this is Andrew Kolsky at Sleep Science Today. We are back. We're talking about neurofeedback and how it works. And we were just about to have Dr. Miko explain to us the different types of devices and how big and how small they are today.
Yeah, You were saying if polysomnography is advised to a would be the right choice for a person with a sleep problem. If a neurologist recommends it, by all means, it's even though it looks a bit scary. I know I'm probably the worst patient. It needs to be done because it looks at different changes in the waveform, looks at the standard EEG during sleep, and so there are things that you need to do in order to have a more comprehensive approach. With what I do, with what neurofeedback allows us to do is to actually take that waveform and break it down in different frequency ranges, and go and put our hands in those frequencies that we think are responsible for a problem. And again, it can work easily with any other type of intervention. I would, what I've seen, patients who were on massive cocktail of drugs. Again, I'm not saying you shouldn't take your drugs, absolutely your medication. But my experience is that some patients were on massive cocktail of drugs and then slowly, they were with me 1-2 years, and slowly reduced them. Now they're medication free and they're just doing neurofeedback. And what really, from a scientific point of view, I find exciting is that their MAPS have changed completely. And they had this persistent and consistent annoying decrease in low frequencies that it took us determination from both the patient and myself to keep working on those frequencies. And today, actually, I recently reviewed some of those MAPS and they're completely different. And the patient is medication-free. Again, from an assessment point of view that you can do easily from home, and it's a lot less intimidating, and you can do, you don't need anyone to put, I have it here, those people who are viewing this on YouTube be able to see it. It's a very, very tiny headset.
So it looks like a horseshoe shape headband, exactly, that would go around your head.
That is hubbed into an electrode, an external electrode that can be moved throughout a scalp.
So I can describe to people. So the electrode that you're holding is basically about the size of a quarter, maybe a small piece of change, and then you would attach that to the appropriate place on your head and to the headset.
Exactly. And there is no injection. There's no piercing of the scalp. And the plate, this gold plate, the golden plate, can be stuck to the scalp using a water-based gel that you can buy and it's going to last you forever. So so it's very... the advantage is that remote neurofeedback allows you to train from whenever, wherever, typically from home, in a quiet place, and whenever you want. We all have busy lives, and sometimes even going to a clinic can be stressful. So, parking, and I used to work actually in a clinic here in Dublin, It can be very stressful, not finding parking, and you just been spending 40 minutes looking for parking. Sometimes in the elderly population, this can be even a major problem. And we don't always have the time. So sitting down for 10 minutes is fantastic to do it in all the sessions that you want.
Right. Well, that was another question that I had. You were talking about the fact that This can be done remotely at home. There's an app that the person uses on their cell phone. Mm-hmm. So then you were saying that they could use programs that are part of the app, or they could even go to YouTube. So can you walk us through if there were a particular video on YouTube that I wanted to use as a patient, what am I actually seeing? What am I doing during a session?
That's a great question. Thank you, Andrew. Well, basically, once you have the app that you have downloaded, you go, you set yourself up, to make sure that the headset is communicating with your phone or tablet, and then you'll be training. So you can go and select, for example, YouTube app, as if you normally do, and you pick any video that you want. What happens is that we talked about how neurofeedback is based on learning. A particular type of activity is rewarded, and then over time, and the brain keeps doing it more and more. So what happens is that you watch a video, and at the beginning, your brain is not going to be very much oscillating that particular frequency in that particular region. And so the image will typically dim or shrink. The sound, you can also play around with the settings. The sound will go down. So whenever instead the brain will be oscillating in that specific frequency in that specific brain region that I selected, then you'll see that the video will be in playing normally. And what's fascinating is that the brain quickly learns how to do it. You don't have to do anything. Some patients ask me, "Oh, I feel that if I look, this way, it's better, and I can get better results." Maybe. But the best way is just let the brain do its job. You just look at the screen, and everything happens without any joystick or anything else. So, the brain starts oscillating in a more chaotic way. And then as soon as it finds something that is salient to that particular program, boom, it starts like tuning in and then functioning better and better for that particular program. So that's how it works. Same thing with games. We have games or a bunch of games. For example, the one I like to play with is the bonfire. So you look at the bonfire and it shrinks when you're not in the zone, and it gets bigger and bigger when you are in the zone. And the game also introduces some distractors that are very, very useful to train the brain to ignore distractors and focus. This is neurofeedback is also used, as I was saying, for performance training. Neurosurgeons use it for improving their attention and just focus on what they have to do without getting the brain in a loop and thinking about other things in the meantime. I could go on and on about this. This is fascinating.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. I mean, we have about 3.5 minutes left, and I did want to get in a question about. So you shared the device that is like a little horseshoe that fits over your forehead and behind your ears. You have a little lead that is then kind of stuck with a gel to your head. Mm-hmm. So the place on your head where you would apply that lead, when you are working with a patient, if they're there for anxiety versus if they're there for sleep or whatever the issue is that lead going to go in a different place? Are they working on different waves? Can you tell us just a little bit about that in the last two or three minutes?
Absolutely. First of all, when we run assessments, we want to have enough data to plot maps. And MindLift in particular uses machine learning to turn data acquisition from a number of spots and apply it also to those spots where we didn't go in physically. So that's one thing that is important. And then when we look at the assessment, we will know where to put, we'll decide. I typically decide that on the basis of my interpretation of the research in that particular field, and also trying to link all the symptoms and you know, the behavioral performance, the psychomotor performance, trying to decide which area, which region of the brain is more important for that particular symptom that we is this causing the stress. We decide where to put the electrode based on evidence. We don't go blind. So without that, and some patients find it like, oh, okay, do I have to do an assessment? Yeah, you have to do it every 4 or 6 weeks. And it's important because otherwise you at least from both scientific but also clinical a clinical point of view, it's absolutely important to guarantee or to at least strive for accuracy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. I just wanted to make sure I clarified that. Yeah. And then the other thing I wanted to clarify, because you said it, but I wanted to make sure that we really focused on it for a minute here, was in terms of any sort of side effects from neurofeedback, can you give us just a brief explanation of that again, whether there are any, and if so, what they might be?
About 60 years of research, there's no side effects documented, and the only side effects can be fatigue, which is transient, and it's like going to the gym and feeling tired after the gym. If you worked out well according to a good program, and then it'll fade out the day after. It'll be fine. Hours later, it'll be fine. It's important. My patients are very eager, of course, like all of us, to improve. And sometimes they overdo. But then, so far, they've never complained about fatigue. It's important anyway that if you feel it, you stop. Because while fatigue is not a major problem, a neurological problem, it can cause problems for example, if you're driving. Not during the neurofeedback, of course, but if you're driving, if you're tired, if you can't focus, and you're slow, and you have to hit the brakes, you know, that can be a huge problem. You know, in the house, if you're handling hot water, if you have babies, and so it's important. So I create very, very short programs, like 9 minutes altogether, uh-huh. You know, three-minute rounds, because also of the equipment. The way the equipment works allows me to jump from create 4 to 7, 8 programs. So, alternate fashion, the patient can go from program to program. So that's why to train as many, depending on the areas that I want to train. Sometimes, you know, it's better to have very few programs, but sometimes I have to create a few more.
All right. Well, I appreciate the information. We've come up against the clock here, so we have to wind down here. I do want to remind people, you know, especially if you're dealing with a sleep issue and you're sleepy during the day and then you have any sort of fatigue, whether it be from neurofeedback or anything, we want to make sure you avoid driving, because sleepy driving can be just as or more dangerous than drunk driving. So, Dr. Amico, thank you for your time. Thank you for explaining all about neurofeedback to us.
Very welcome.
Yep. So for those of you listening, feel free to join us and visit us at sleepsciencetoday.com. You can join our mailing list there and be notified of all sorts of upcoming events. You can get a free ebook, and you can also see my new book, Why Can't I Sleep Well? So until we see you on our next episode, thank you for signing in, and thank you for joining us. And Dr. Amico, thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, sleep science today and sleep better tonight.